This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 23rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Chris Weiss-Sopel. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Gary.
Chris Weiss-Sopel, once known as Weld Pond, is the founder and CTO of Veracode. Chris is a computer scientist by training with a BS from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. In a previous life, Chris was one of the seven original members of the Loft Hacker Collective. He then went on to work for At Stake as a consultant and a spokesmodel. Chris wrote the book, The Art of Software Security Testing. He lives in Boston, in the metropolitan area, with his fiance, Deborah Cavalier. So, did I say her name right?
Cavalier.
Cavalier. Close. Okay, so let's get started. I think the first time I met you was in 1996. At the Loft.
Sounds about right.
I was trying to remember if it was 96 or 97. So that was a really cool place. You guys famously claimed back then that you could take down the internet in 30 minutes in congressional testimony. So I've always wondered how.
Essentially, that was some research that Mudge was doing on, at the time, it was on a network he had legitimate access to play with a lot of BGP
BGP
routers.
Mm-hmm.
Routers running BGP.
Yep.
And a nice test lab set up. And he found some problems where people weren't following best practices and filtering out BGP from not filtering out non-peers.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to send things like BGP reset packets and
right.
have routes get taken down.
I'm pretty sure you can still do that.
I think in places you still can, just like there may have been a place that you could blue box up until a few years ago. But
uh-huh.
I think most places have the proper filtering in place, or they have those they have private network links. Between big peering routers.
Sure, yeah. So what's become of the original group of Loft guys?
It's interesting you say that because we're kind of getting the band back together for one performance at Source Boston, which is a security conference in March.
Oh, cool. It's kind of like the police, I guess.
And I think the six of us are going to be up on stage talking about, you know, what we've seen since the beginning of 2000, really, when we sort of just got subsumed by At Stake.
I thought there were seven of you. Was I wrong about that?
One guy, Joe Grand, is out in San Francisco.
Gotcha.
And he's actually working on a documentary series on technology.
Uh-huh.
And so he's not able to get away from that.
Oh, that's too bad. So is everybody still in security? Have they sort of gone a million different directions? How's that?
I would say about half of us are still in security. The other half are just sort of in general technology. I guess, you know, a lot of the Loft guys, you know, especially the non software guys, the
mm-hmm.
hardware kind
mm-hmm.
of guys,
mm-hmm.
they weren't, you know, they were only sort of involved in security tangentially.
Sure. Well, they were mostly interested in how stuff works
and figuring out like how wireless networks work and things like that. And, you know, security is part of that. But that, you know, that's sort of the more general hacking. You know, hacking isn't just security. Security is just one form of it, I say.
Oh, I completely agree with you. And it's kind of a mindset, you know, that you either grow up with or you don't.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, you know, for me, hacking is, you know, figuring out how something works and then, you know, playing with it, modifying it, sort of making it your own. And, you know, some of that might be, you know, bypassing the security mechanisms on the system. But a lot of times, it's just getting the system to do something it wasn't designed to do, which may not be a security problem. It might just be fun.
Right, yep. Well, way back in the mid to late 90s, the role of researchers, security researchers,
mm-hmm.
finding security problems was pretty different than it is today, I think. And the Loft regularly published exploits and outed vendors. I did the same thing myself with the Princeton team where we made a habit of breaking Java. So I think back then, to some extent, that helped make the general public aware of security issues. What do you think the role of researchers is like now, and how's that changed over the last decade?
Yeah, I agree that what people were doing back then was raising awareness that there were, you know, serious security problems that needed to be fixed in a timely way, or bad things were going to happen, and that sort of paradigm didn't exist by the people who were making the technology. They certainly didn't see the things that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think they actually do. It probably took at least 5 or 6 years for them to get it. Now I see the role of researcher as, you know, more longer term, not looking for that, you know, single point vulnerability, which I know you like to call a bug, and more looking for new classes of attack. So really, you know, you might find an instance of a problem, but it's really not finding an instance of a problem that is well known, like finding yet another buffer overflow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how boring is that? But, you know, finding something new, like saying, hey, look at this cross, you know, site request forgery or something like that. I'm trying to understand new attacks that are possible because of, you know, the way that we're building applications or you know, other technologies are change over time. So there's always new attacks to new technology, and I see the researcher as working at that level now.
So you think they're playing a critical role, and people should continue to do,
yeah,
that sort of thing?
Yeah, I really do. I think that, you know, the standard adoption of technology is, you know, the engineers come up with a cool new framework or a new mechanism for doing something, and all the software developers, you know, jump on it and start to build using that.
Mm-hmm.
And then attacks happen.
Right.
Because you know, the new attack vectors open up. And, you know, in part of that iterative technology process, I think there needs to be an iterative security research process that hopefully can catch up and get ahead of before everyone starts implementing the technology, but I guess I'm not that hopeful.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still really stuck in an auditing role these days, even though, you know, a lot of us have been saying, geez, we need to get into engineering instead of, you know, being the auditors after the fact. And the question is, how early can you go? Can you teach people that are building our stuff to really do it right or not?
Well, the rush to implement using, you know, new unproven, you know, frameworks or new unproven languages or new unproven APIs or new unproven protocols, that pull is just so hard that it's hard to get upstream of that. I remember when, J2EE started to percolate and be used in, you know, around 2000 or so, that everyone just started writing these applications, and people would come to us at stake and say, can you write a primer on all the different things I should look out for? And I was like, well, you know,
not yet.
There's a book on that, and, you know, but people don't read the book and then code.
Right.
They code, and they get far along, and then they start to worry about it. And that's really the mindset we need to change. I know an old friend of mine, Hobbit, who used to be associated with the Loft, he would always use software that was always like 3 or 4 years old, because he would always say, like, you know, all the sort of design level things that people are going to figure out have already been figured out for the older stuff.
Right. So you founded VulnWatch way back when.
Yeah.
I think partially as a reaction to Symantec gobbling up BugTrack. Is that list still active?
It is still active, but I think shortly after it became, you know, somewhat obsolete, because there was another source of information, which was the full disclosure list.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some other smaller lists like Daily Dave and other places. And, it was really founded in the reaction that we need more than one centralized place for the free discussion of vulnerabilities.
Sure.
And I didn't want to have just like one moderator controlling what the whole community was seeing.
Well, especially when it was kind of a commercial interest.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Yep, I think that was a good thing. I still think those lists play an important role in security. Do you agree?
Yeah, I see them as sort of a backstop. Like, you know, you can't get away with sort of suppressing, vulnerability information. It will eventually get out. And, you know, I want things to be fixed before, vulnerability information is discussed. But,
yep.
You know, when there's active attacks happening or people are refusing to fix things, it's sort of that last chance to let people protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. One of the times you and I had a public difference of opinion was sort of around that, when we released information about Microsoft's copy of StatGuard, their design flaw. This was about 2002, I think. And it actually sparked a debate about full disclosure, which was interesting because we weren't really disclosing a bug that people could use to exploit. But nonetheless, I think it was important to talk about full disclosure. What is your position on that these days?
Talking about problems with the stack checking functionality?
No, not about that in particular, just the whole notion of full disclosure, you know, what role that should play, when you should talk to vendors and all that jazz.
Yeah, well, I really think that the goal should be for all the information to eventually get out there in all the gory details that need to be out there in order for people to learn. And it's just this a timeline that's associated with that to try to lessen the risk. You can never have zero risk because there will always be someone who not paying attention or not patching or whatever, and you know, mm-hmm. we shouldn't be responsible for everyone. But you know, I think the vast majority of the risk goes away if the vendor is responsible and if the vendor acts in a timely way and also has the threat of the disclosure will happen even if they don't act.
Right, right.
And you know, it's like one of these things. It's like democracy. It has its problems, but it's the best system that we know of.
Sure.
And I still think of it that way.
Yep. I pretty much agree with you. So AtStake was formed out of the Loft and Ted Julian and Dan Gere, maybe some other people. But what was it like to work for such a hot startup in the boom days?
It was pretty exciting. The real excitement factor was how the talent just kind of snowballed. We didn't, as the Loft, we didn't just want to go anywhere. We wanted to make sure we were going to something which, you know, had good leadership, was well-backed, and that there was going to be other smart people there. And, you know, our first, the first thing that said, there'll be other smart people there was, you know, Dan Gere approached us and says, you know, if you join AtStake, I'm thinking about doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of snowballed from there, where we were able to attract four people from the NSA, people like David Litchfield came on board, and it was just exciting to just see us keep amassing all these well-respected people.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty exciting aspect of it. The problem with it was there was only so many of those top people you could get. So
right.
at some point,
a monopoly would have been better.
Yeah. At some point, it kind of the well kind of got dry. And, you know, there weren't any other people that were already, you know, experts and well-known or whatever. So I think we got up to about 100 consultants at one point, but it became hard to grow any bigger.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly had more customers than we had the ability to deliver at that time.
So over time, AtStake sort of shifted from a pure play in the security services space to more of a software security niche, I guess, before its ultimate acquisition by Symantec. What is your view of the software security market now?
So the software security market, how are you defining that?
Oh, I guess people thinking about software engineering and thinking about software assurance, things like code review, the stuff you're doing now at Veracode, that whole market writ large.
Sure. So you're right that we AtStake did gravitate towards that, and I think there was a few reasons. One was other areas of the security industry were getting there was more talent in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So there were other companies that, you know, just did forensics or just did compliance or mm-hmm. Things of that nature. Also, we realized that we had sort of a critical mass of the talent pool that we had that was really good at application security. I think we counted at one point that we had 40 people that we considered having the skill set to go on an application security consulting engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one time when I remember we were trying to hire a guy away from IBM Global Services, who was a web pen tester. And I said, so how many people does IBM have that do exactly what you do, web pen testing? And he said, oh, we have two. And I'm like, IBM Global Services has two. You know, this is back in like 2002.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, I was like, wow, they have two and we have like 40. That's pretty good.
Yep.
So I think we decided that we would just concentrate on that and try to sell that and work on building up our tool set to get better and better in that direction. I think it was a good decision because a lot of the other security service were getting commoditized with things like Qualys getting rid of manual, you know, network scans and
sure.
things like that.
Sure. Do you think that market is continuing to grow?
Yeah, I think it is continuing to grow. I think that, you know, that the very top tier of the risk profile, be it either, you know, you're a large software company with a big brand at risk, or you're making, you know, software that's being put in a pretty risky environment. That area of the market, sort of the tip of the pyramid, I think is, you know, sort of at least a few years down the path of improving their security development processes. But I just see that there's a huge section of the industry that really hasn't done anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller ISVs, a lot of the outsourcers. There's a lot of companies that write their own custom software who really have done nothing except, you know, maybe read a book.
Right. if they manage to do that.
Yeah, if they're lucky. I mean, when we get code uploaded to us at Veracode from our customers, you know, sometimes it's like night and day. Like some of the code is very good and some of it is just horrible. And usually the good code is coming from one of those top 10 ISVs, which is saying, you know, can Veracode, you know, find yet another vulnerability in my code?
Uh-huh.
And some of it is coming from people that have done nothing, and it's just horrible.
Yeah, they find out how much trouble they're in.
Yeah, exactly. So I see it as the industry right now is we have people doing excellent software security and even trying to get better, and then we have a lot of people doing nothing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think, well, another way of putting that is that the days of the badnessometer are not over yet, because not enough people have run the badnessometer on their own stuff to find out how bad they are.
That is definitely true. A lot of people haven't run it.
So you're back in the startup game again with Veracode, and you guys do binary analysis and code assurance services, I suppose.
Yes.
What advantages and disadvantages does a binary level approach to code review bring?
I think that the advantage of binary is you know, theoretically, it is the ground truth. It's what the CPU is running. Ultimately, at least for low level defects, it should be able to be just as good as looking at source code or other levels. But you know, practically, binary analysis is more difficult, and it did take us longer to build our technology than some of the people doing static analysis at the source code level. We also have found that we need to use debug symbolic information to get our accuracy to the level of the source code tools.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel that, you know, we've come up with a little bit of a hybrid approach where we're getting some of the benefits of source code tools by looking at, by using type information, and we're getting some low-level benefits of not having to make assumptions about what the compiler was going to do with the source code when it gets down to the binary. So I see it as, you know, some gains and losses. It's just a little bit of a different type of analysis.
So in my work, I like to emphasize that defects come in two flavors, and you alluded to that before: bugs at the implementation level and flaws at the architectural level.
Mm-hmm.
And these divide up roughly 50-50 in practice. And so the question is, what are we supposed to do about flaws? Like, how do you test for architectural problems realistically?
Yeah, that's a pretty difficult one. My dream is to be able to automate that one somehow. You know, someone comes in and maybe dictates their design to you or something, and they figure it out.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, the doctor's able to diagnose your problems by sort of asking you some questions.
But I
haven't really seen that work well. I've seen that, you know, whenever you need to do that design level review, it's something which takes, typically, you know, a few man weeks of expert time
and a lot of experience, yeah,
on the part of the architects who built it, and it becomes pretty expensive.
Yeah.
I think you have to do it, especially, you know, the higher the risk software, the more important it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see a quick solution around the corner for that problem.
So a couple of quick ending up questions. Whatever became of the Loft warehouse? Wasn't that in Waterton? Is that where it was?
Yeah, so the Loft warehouse where we last ended up was actually the second loft. The first one was in the south end of Boston.
We were there for
the first half of the 90s, and that actually got converted into some luxury condos.
Irony.
So that building turned out okay. So it's still standing. The Watertown building, I think, was always a substandard building, and that's maybe why our rent was so cheap. We actually shared the second floor with a Russian radio station, which they translated the American news wires into Russian.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So you could see the kind of budget people had.
What happened to all the stuff? You mean, you guys had an unbelievable pile.
Actually, the building, we took some of it to At Stake, the good stuff. We put into a dumpster the rest of it. The building ended up getting torn down about a year later.
Well, I was going to ask if you still dumpster dive for supercomputers, but I suppose if you just ditched some into the dumpster, that the whole thing had turned 360.
Exactly. Actually, once we threw the stuff away, we did let the local the next tier down of dumpster divers, I guess, come and, you know, recycle yet again. I just see dumpster diving as it's ecologically sound anyway.
Right. So you don't do that anymore, really.
every once in a while I get an impulse, part of being in a relationship with someone you have to live with, sometimes you're not able to bring that stuff home.
Well, thanks. This has been really fun.
Okay.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw, the March-April 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Is a special issue devoted to all aspects of identity management. Listeners should also make sure to check out the Building Security In department. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where Silver Bullet excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.